Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Farron, and tonight our topic is the director, Richard Linklater. Joining me tonight are my guests, Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Perry Seibert. Say hello.
No vacancy. Yeah.
And Carl Kafer. Say hello.
Say hello. I just did.
Mm-hmm. Now, Linklater's been around for a long time. He started doing movies in the 80s, little tiny movies, student films. He's really been at the vanguard of the American independent film scene since the 80s, although it wasn't until the early 90s that he really got on most people's maps with Slacker and Dazed and Confused. But, you know, I want to ask this question that I always ask. How did we first come to Linklater? And I'll take it to you, Carl. How did you first come to Linklater?
Well, I think the answer to that is Slacker, but I don't really remember if I saw Slacker first or Dazed and Confused. But by Dazed and Confused, that's the one that really hit me hard. And that's the one that made me notice Linklater. So I would have to say Dazed and Confused.
So, Perry, you?
This is so weird for me. I cannot think of a director I love more that I don't remember my origin with them. I really don't. It should have been Dazed and Confused, but I think I saw Before Sun, and I think I saw it on VHS. And then Double Back,
yeah.
I knew him. I'd heard of Slacker. I mean, it was out there, and I don't think I ever sought it out. I don't know why I didn't see Dazed and Confused at the time. I was in college when it came out, but I didn't. and so I think it was that, but again, it wasn't like, oh, here's this guy. I knew who he was. I knew of him, and it was slow getting to him, because I think the first one I saw in the theater was The Newton Boys.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I had seen Before Sunrise before that. No,
mm-hmm.
No. Well, I don't know if I saw Newton Boys or Suburbia first. I know I saw
well,
them both.
Well, it's possible.
That was within the first one.
Well,
right.
I'm going to say this. You know, I'm pretty sure that I saw at least part of Slacker or Dazed and Confused on TV back in the day, but I'm not going to count that. So I know for a fact that the first time that I saw a Linklater film where I knew that this was a Linklater movie would be The Newton Boys. You know, I knew he had done other movies, and that they'd all been pretty well received, but that was the first one. And, you know, I've gone back and seen all of his movies, and I haven't missed one since. Now, I haven't seen them all in the theater, but, you know, I've seen them since. So, finally, to you, Aaron, what about you?
I've been racking my brain about this one. I know the first one I saw was School of Rock, but that was not, I didn't see it because of Linklater. But the next year, I remember Before Sunset coming out. I had not seen Before Sunrise at that point, but I remember Before Sunset coming out and thinking, that's not really a movie you would think sequel. And I found that, like, I tucked that away for when I would eventually see it. And then the one where I, like, saw it and knew kind of, like, okay, I'm following this guy was a Scanner Darkly, which came out when I was in college.
Interesting. Now, I will go to you for this next one, Perry. What are the major themes of Linklater's work?
Time. I know this is a slam dunk of an answer, but it's the answer. It's time.
Of course it
no,
is.
Yeah, there's a lot of other stuff. I mean, it's time, and it's also the most possible constructive understanding of rebellion and formulating a self-identity. Those are really the two things that are at the core of every single one of the films. I don't think there's an example of one that doesn't do one of those two, if not both, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them do both. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is as much as I have problems with one of his movies, in particular an early film that treads on, that of course deals very directly with those issues. Yeah, his interest in time and the construction of self is there from the beginning. So,
oh yeah.
So, what about you, Aaron? Would you do you have anything to add or expand on to what Perry said about time?
As far as like true themes, no. I think that he is also very much defined by being a talky yet kinetic filmmaker. He always said that Raging Bull inspired him to become a filmmaker, but he filters John Cassavetes through Martin Scorsese to come up with something entirely unique. There's no one like him, and no one's tried.
He should be
more influential than he is.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you watch his work, and yeah, there's elements of Scorsese, and there's elements of Cassavetes. There's even a couple of movies where you sit there and you could think there's a touch of Almodovar or Hitchcock, and even occasionally a little bit of Wes Anderson or Cameron Crowe. So, you know, but the thing is except for the ones that came before, you have to wonder, since most of these guys came out around the same time, did they influence each other, or was there just something in the generation they came from that brought about similar sensibilities? Maybe that's something we can get into a little later. You, Carl, anything that you want to add to this?
I think also in terms of time, you're looking at a reflection of a time. Okay, and it's also about the passing of time, of course, with Boyhood, what he's doing with Merrily, We Roll Along, but more the reflection of the time. And with that, he does share a lot with Wes Anderson. And I see a lot of similarities, not in their style, but in what they're talking about. Because each of his movies have a sense of time. They also have a sense of place, a very specific sense of place. And I think that's the main thing here.
So now I'm going to ask you a question, Aaron, and that is this. Who's his most important collaborator?
I go to two. Obviously, Ethan Hawke, both in front of and behind the camera. And then Lee Daniel has been his consummate cinematographer all the way back to Slacker. I think there's two or three films they did not do together, but those two go hand in hand for the most part. So, yeah. Those two guys.
Carl?
I have to say Lee Daniel. I think that is a partnership made in heaven. Seriously. That's who I would say.
Yeah, especially when you look at how, you know, because Boyhood, I mean, my God, that was hard. Shooting that over such a long period, you know, keeping everything consistent in terms of look,
oh, yeah.
Yet making sure that you absolutely know there's been time that's passed, and you look at the Before trilogy, and obviously those are gorgeous locations, but that doesn't mean that you're still going to get cinematography that helps tell the story. And I think it's a nice fit. So I would absolutely go with either of those, either Hawk or Daniel as my choice. Perry?
Sandra Dare is my obvious number one over both of those. I think that once he's – if we're agreeing that he is arguably the greatest American director who's focused on time, I will take the editor he has stuck with for pretty much the entire career. I think that's unbeatable.
Interesting. Any examples you want to give about why you chose that? I mean, I'm not saying that any of us are right or wrong, just I think
right.
Because that's a very interesting choice, and I'm glad somebody brought it up. But, yeah.
Like I said, I mean, and this will get into what, I figured we'd get – I figured we'd go full nerd a little bit later. But, I mean, it's not just that it's like Carl was saying earlier. It's not just that it's about time. It's about all the ways we can think about time. He doesn't just deal in time in one specific way. And so to stick with somebody who has the understanding of what he wants to do and the collaborative ability to create Boyhood and also Before Sunset and also Apollo 10 and a half, that's remarkable. And you're only going to pull that off in the editing suite. There's mm-hmm. That's it. There's not one screenwriter he goes back to, so it's not that. And Daniel's a fantastic pick. I mean, he's the other obvious pick. I agree. I will take Sandra Dare, and I had it before. I'm not saying it just because I didn't want to say the Daniel. You guys did. I had Sandra Dare down as my first choice. I don't go with Ethan Hawke only because I think that Ethan Hawke needs him so much more than he needs Ethan Hawke.
That's fair.
Until about 6 or so years ago, I honestly thought Ethan Hawke is a bad actor outside of Linklater films. I don't know what he does to him that makes him so palatable to me and so appealing when he's never been that way for me in any other film until about 6 or 7 years ago when he got old enough to calm the hell down. That's why Hawke doesn't make the short list for me. But Sandra Dare.
Now I'm
going to
ask you this question, and this is about Hawke. Have you seen The Black Phone?
I haven't yet. I'm not saying he's perfect every time now, but he's done very good work outside of Linklater films.
Yeah, no, because I was going to say, I just saw The Black Phone within the last week or so, and I have to say, he has a major role in it, and it's something where you could chew a lot of scenery, but he manages to make that part convincingly horrifying.
Good.
He does a really good job there.
I always thought the quintessential moment of early Hawk for me with Linklater was Tape, where it's like, yes, of course you give him the part where it's a guy who just for nonsense is doing somersaults on the bed while he talks. Yes, that's exactly right. You just know how to use Ethan Hawke in a way no one else seems to.
So, Carl?
Yes.
Sorry, I was going to say, did you have something to say?
No, not at all.
I thought I heard. Maybe that must be static on the line. I thought I heard one of you guys say something. I must be getting bounce on my line, guys. Interesting. That hasn't happened since I was at a family member's house ages ago that still has a damn party line. That is so bizarre. So that's actually throwing me off my game. That is embarrassing. Wow, that is so weird. So we will go to you, Carl, now, and we will ask this question. What is his greatest strength as a filmmaker?
I was pondering this when you sent the questions, and I just think, again, it has to do with me with sense of place, that there is a intimate nostalgia with Linklater, and it's personal, which is different than Anderson, which I don't think is personal. But I think by looking at his films and understanding that a lot of this has to do with his own persona and how he perceives it, I think we really see this sense of place and this sense of nostalgia and this love of the past. Or in the case of School of Rock, not so much the past as the history of music, or whatever the case would be. He's interested so much in the past, and it's a very, very personal revelation in each of his films. So that's what I would say.
Perry?
If you'll allow me to, because I think they cover the full spectrum of what Linklater does for me. I don't think, here's my first grand pronouncement of the evening, and there will be more. I don't think there is, I don't think I can name an American director who has improved upon, has been better than him. There's some who match him. At simply conceiving every single film he's going to make is. I think he has such a strong understanding of his themes and how he wants to accomplish them, leaving enough openness to collaborate with that. I can't think of a film that missed. Okay, I can think of one. It's the one we'll get to later. There's only one film in history that completely missteps. Where it's like, wow, you lost your way. You don't know what you're doing. You're finding this in a bad way, not in a good way. You're not there. You're either, you know, you've either pre-decided this is how it has to be and it's not working and you don't know how to recorrect, or it's so open you don't know what you're doing anymore. I don't think he's, with one exception, he's ever misstepped in this capacity. And I don't think he even missteps in that capacity. I think he just gets it wrong. We'll get back to this. For me, he is such an incredibly intellectual director without being alienating in any capacity in that way. He's so close. He and Soderbergh have so much in common, except that Soderbergh will run headlong into the constriction he wants to make the movie in. Like, you know, he's going to make the good German look like that, whether or not it's actually a good idea to do it that way. Where Linklater doesn't make that mistake, right? And the other thing that ties into that with me, for me, and it's connected, he's so good with actors.
Can I just say as an aside, you know, what Soderbergh did with Good German and the look of that movie, I think was a detriment to it as well. And the next time a film tried that and failed as spectacularly for me was Mank. And the thing is, I love Fincher and Soderbergh, so to see them try something that I should have liked and then hating it that much.
Mank's a better movie.
Mank
has more
of a
right to like that than the Good German.
This is how little I liked Mank. It's only a little bit better of a movie than the Good German.
That's fine. It's better. That's fine.
Okay.
So, Aaron?
He's always running in danger of, I think, like Perry said, alienating his audience, but he never actually does it. He always keeps you engaged. I think it goes back to how kinetic he is, and that is one of the reasons that I went with Lee Daniel as his key collaborator, is that the camera never stops moving. So even though the movies are just really long takes of two interesting-looking people talking 90% of the time, you're always engaged. And they could be talking about art, or they could be talking about some obscure philosophy text, or they could just be talking about politics or baseball. There's always, like, he as Harry did say, he's so in tune with his interests. And as Carl said, all of his films are so personal. I think that when somebody is personally passionate about something, it doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter if we share that interest. I think that most engaged audiences are going to be sucked into that passion because they want to see where it's going, and they want to see what makes somebody else click. What makes
It's just like I have a problem with one of his major movies, and it's not that I don't accept that things were like that. It's that I reject the notion that we should passively say that was okay because that's just how it was back then. But we'll get to that later. Perry, this is your chance. What is his worst movie? What is Linklater's big fucking diarrhea pile? His pool of condor shit.
It's not that bad. It is the one time I truly think he misjudged that the idea was good. It's the Bad News Bears remake, which is, I understand.
Damn, I always forget he did that.
School of Rock had a giant, was a giant hit. Bad Santa was a giant hit. I understand how this deal gets packaged, but that's the problem. It feels like a deal that gets packaged, and what's missing is the film is a reverent ode to irreverence. That doesn't work. That's a bad idea. That just doesn't work. I don't understand.
Okay, I'm gonna co-sign this. I'm gonna co-sign this. I got nothing.
I will go so far as to say the reason it stands out is because it's the only misstep like that in the filmography to me. There isn't a bad film. And that's just like a waste of time. It's not a bad movie. It's a bad movie because he made it. Like, you know, it's like why? Other than
it's like I have discussing pre-show, there's a major movie that he did that I have huge problems with. But as much as it's my least favorite film, I'm going to have to say that, Bad News Bears objectively is the weakest film. So what about you, Aaron?
I totally disagree. First of all, I think Bad News Bears is so charming. It shouldn't work. I went into it dreading it. I knew its reputation. I'm not a huge Billy Bob Thornton fan. But just was smiling ear to ear the entire time. I also have to give it a pass because it is, as he said, one of two movies he ever made that would have been made with or without him. He just decided to sign on. So take that how you will. For me, like the film I ranked the lowest, I feel bad about because we wouldn't even know it existed if it weren't for Criterion Collection. Which is his $3,000 Super 8 first film. And it's not bad. Still really like it. I wrote a 4-page essay on it. I don't think he's ever made a bad movie. I don't think he's ever made a movie I dislike. It's just that it was a $3,000 Super 8 movie, and you can tell.
You know, I think it's very rare that we have a director where we can say, he has films that are weak that are probably his worst films, but are they actually what we could call a bad movie? You know, does he have a North? Does he have a Buddy Buddy? No, I don't think so. So, Carl?
Well, you know, we just did a commentary watch on the original Bad News Bears, and I don't think it's his worst film, but I think it's his most unnecessary film. However,
I can agree with that.
Okay. However, the one I was most disappointed with was Everybody Wants Some.
You, yeah, interesting. I have to say that I still don't know what to think of it.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't know what to think of it either. I'm not saying it's bad. It's not. But you know, considering its pedigree and where it comes from, I have some problems with it. You know, I mean,
I will go to the map for that movie.
And I understand that. I absolutely understand that. And we'll get more into that when we talk about Adam's film that he's going to talk about. And there's a lot to this, okay? But I was disappointed with it. Again, I think it's a good movie, but I was just disappointed. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
So now we get back to, and this will be Aaron's chance. Of all of his works, what's his most undervalued? It can be one of your ones that ends up on your top five, and you can take a chance to talk about it now, but if it's off your top five, but you still think it's the one that he did that people need to know more about, this is your chance to give a spotlight. So what's his most undervalued, underappreciated work?
Of literally all of his movies, are all of the questions you asked us. This was the hardest one for me because I think that all of them are undervalued to one degree or another.
Amen.
Up to and including the Before trilogy and Boyhood, which are the two that I think have gained the most traction. But picking one, I have to go with me and Orson Welles. Because it kicked off what I think is the most sustained period of excellence of his career, and nobody saw it. It had probably the most stars he had in a movie until he made Where'd You Go, Bernadette, with Claire Danes, who was the it girl at the time, and Zac Efron, who was really coming off a stretch of hits for teens. And so it had a built-in audience. And then the performance there of Orson Welles was just impeccable.
Christian McKay.
The story it told. Chris McKay.
Yeah, Christian McKay really should have been up for an Oscar. I know we don't talk about that much on this show, but damn.
He was incredible. So that's if I have to pick one, because I think it's an underrated career. But if I have to pick one, that's my pick.
Yeah, well I had to flip a coin. And then I had to flip a coin again because I had three. me and Orson Welles was my number two most underrated. The one that seems for me that people keep forgetting about, but damn if that isn't a good movie, is Bernie. I think Bernie is wonderful. Bernie, I had not gotten a chance to see School of Rock yet. It was one of those movies where it was on my radar. I knew it was there, and I just kept putting it off, and I didn't get a chance to see it until after I saw Bernie. But when I saw Bernie, it made me reevaluate Jack Black a little. I still don't think he's the greatest thing ever, but you know, give the man the right material, and he can do really good work. So, you know, but that's got a marvelous cast. I mean, McConaughey and McClane. It's just a terrific film. So, what about you, Carl?
This one was easy. This one was so easy. Last Flag Flying, no question.
Ooh.
Nobody knows it. It is fucking brilliant. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I'll talk about a film that we all should love. And that's The Last Detail.
Amen.
Okay? This is the direct sequel Daryl Ponickstein, who wrote the original novel and script for Last Detail. Then years later, in I think 2002, wrote and published Last Flag Flying. It is the same characters. But unfortunately, in because of copyright, they couldn't name them the same. But they are the same characters. And so you have Bryan Cranston in a Jack Nicholson role. You've got Steve Carell in a Dennis Quaid role. And you've got Lawrence Fishburne in the Otis Young role. And what happens with this is so personal and so, it's just, it's an amazing film. It's on Netflix. Nobody saw it. Go fucking see it now.
Best
film he ever did. It's my number one. Absolutely.
It's a superb work. So, Perry.
So you had three, I had four.
to be fair, I had 19.
I only had one. Sorry, guys.
I was about to say, co-signing on pretty much everything everybody has said since this question has started, because Last Flag Flying is absolutely on that list, and I agree. It's not going to be my answer. Totally agree. Incredibly undervalued. Here's for me where it comes down to with the four films I'm looking at. I'm going to land my criteria now is undervalued in the sense that it is genuinely about something incredibly important. And it deals with it superbly and in a way that in another time and place, it would have connected. People would have stood up and said, yeah, this is doing something. This is important. And for whatever reason, for all of Linklater's insistence on time, he is out of time. He just doesn't connect like we all want him to with the culture, right? So that's why Last Flag Flying would be second, but my top is The Scanner Darkly, which I think is the greatest film ever made about drugs. That's a stunning.
My number
two.
You
know, what gets me is that wonderful quote where the quote from Philip K. Dick himself, where it lists all the friends and family that he lost to drugs, and that alone, drives home the reality of addiction.
Yeah, it's on top of that, it's an amazing piece of cinema. It's also super important. It's heuristically undervalued.
You know, and I remember people when it came out, they said, "Oh my God, Keanu Reeves, he's gonna ruin another movie." And I'm like, "Leave the guy alone." This looks like a trippy fucking movie, and it sure was, and it was a damn good one too.
Mm-hmm.
If I could add something here, I just want to say that I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan. I was on that radar the moment it was announced. And when I finally got to see it, it is, along with Radio Free Album, was the most faithful adaptation of Philip K. Dick. When you talk about that last frontispiece of the people that died and were affected by drugs, I remember reading that. And literally going into tears. Then when I saw it in the film, I was in tears again.
Mm-hmm.
That's how powerful that film is. It is brilliant.
Oh, it really is a remarkable work. So Carl. Here's the next question for you. Which era of Linklater do you prefer? His early stuff up to around that, you know, Before Sunrise and Suburbia, or do you prefer the stuff that came after that, after he started to really get bigger projects and people started to really know his name?
I make no delineation between them at all. None.
Mm-hmm, fair enough.
None.
Neither do I. It was a question because it has come up in some conversations I've had over the years. Some people are like stuck on his first two or three films after a student film, and I'm like, really? So I just thought it'd be an interesting question to ask.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that completely. But to be honest, I think we've got a full sense of his work. He starts somewhere and he moves along. You can see the journey within the whole plethora of his work, and I think that's fascinating. Seriously.
Mhm. Mhm. So, Aaron, you?
I think it's a little unfair to judge his first three films plus Super Independent versus the rest of his career.
Maybe his first four or five.
Yeah. Instead, I do think he pretty much his deal in those first three films. For the purpose of this conversation, I will skip the talk about Impossible to Learn to Plow by Reading Books and consider Slacker his first true film, which I think he would too. So if you look at Slacker, Dazed and Confused, and Before Sunrise, all great films in my estimation, I think you see all of the fascinations he has throughout his career. That being said, he matures those themes, and he is rolling, full steam ahead by the time he hits the mid-2000s. I like Bad News Bears more than the rest of you, but take Bad News Bears out, and he really hasn't had a misstep since Waking Life. And that's an incredible run.
Yeah, and Waking Life isn't a bad movie. It's just an odd
movie. Well, no, I'm saying that, Newton Boys was the last misstep, if you want to call it that.
I would agree.
Other than Bad News Bears.
Yeah,
I have no problem with
Newton Boys.
Newton
Boys is fun, but it's minor.
Yes, but Waking Life is a masterpiece, and that's what I'm getting at. And once he hits Waking Life, the game changes. That's kind of what I'm getting at here.
I'm gonna have to say that between Scanner Darkly and Waking Life, which often get compared because of the visuals. I agree. They're both great films, but I probably connect a little more with A Scanner Darkly, just because I've always been drawn more to stories about addiction and obsession than what was going on in Waking Life. Although Waking Life shares a lot of similarities with his Before trilogy, which is one of my favorite trilogies of all time. So they're both incredible works. Perry?
So I love this question, and of course I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to explain why I love this question so much. Because honestly, time-wise, and it's more fun for me to think about this because it's Linklater, so we're talking about time. It is stunning that, Slacker through the Newton Boys is the 90s, and then he takes a three-year break. So Waking Life and Tape come out almost simultaneously in 2001, and that runs through Me and Orson Welles in 2008, and then it's another three-year break. And he's back with Bernie, and Bernie to Bernadette is 11 to 19, and then there's another three-year break to Apollo 10 and a half. So he has this sort of rhythm that he's developed.
Yeah, I mean, so seriously, Waking Life and Tape came out within two or three weeks of each other.
Yeah, I remember. I remember seeing them both and absolutely loving both of them. I adore Waking Life. I'm all about the easiest philosophy 101 class you could ever take. I love Waking Life. That's fantastic. I loved Waking Life.
Now, can we all agree? Can we all agree that the characters in Waking Life that are clearly that are played by Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke are supposed to be their characters from the Before trilogy?
It's Jesse and Celine. There's no doubt.
Yeah, but I don't think it's canon.
No, I agree with that. So, it's a dream sequel.
So, yeah,
oh, no.
It's a dream, so I don't care. It's all good. So, yeah, I don't have a favorite of those three. Yes, absolutely right. Once that second era, wow, nothing like it. But I'm, you know, I'm excited to see what this next, what this decade brings. I'm super eager, and Apollo 10 has a hell of a start to it, so.
Yeah,
but let's not forget he's got a movie that's about 24 years away.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He won't be around for that one, I'm afraid, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, I mean, you know, 25 years, because that's what they're saying, 25 years for Merrily We Roll Along.
I
Jesus
it was
Christ.
20.
Is it 20? Well, still.
Will anybody want to watch Beanie Feldstein at this point? I don't know. I will
say, can they recast?
But I don't know.
Can they recast?
I don't know. Linkletter can do anything, so yeah. But I don't know.
But honestly, I think Feldstein was fine as Monica Lewinsky in the Clinton miniseries on FX last season, but you know, she's always been one of those people that they keep trying to sell her, and I'm like, yeah, she's okay, but what's the big deal? And I know that there was the big flap over what happened with her in Gypsy, but I don't want to get into that right now. So,
that wasn't a necessary smack at her. It's just the point.
Oh no,
head.
I know.
Not,
I know. It's
just her
reputation.
I don't dislike her or hate her.
No, it's just her. I get it. Her reputation right now. She's a bit of a, you know, unfortunately, just as her career was starting to take off, you know, now people are starting to say, "Ooh, is she actually box office poison?" And that may be unfortunate because, like I said, you know, she was very good in the Clinton miniseries. She was neither good nor bad in everything else. She was serviceable. She was somebody I was willing to see how she developed as an actress. And I honestly hope that the flap over Gypsy doesn't derail her career because I get the feeling, and I will say this,
well,
and I actually will say this, I don't think it was all on her. I think that was a perfect storm of wrong decisions.
Let's not forget, like, it took her brother a few years to figure things out, but once he did, he's been solid gold since. So
good.
Yeah, and honestly, her brother actually reminds me of. I had feelings about her brother similar to how I felt about Jack Black prior to Bernie. Until I saw, you know, and that's what changed me for Jack Black. Well, what changed my feelings on Jonah Hill, Wolf of Wall Street. I saw that and I was like, well, shit.
Mm-hmm.
Because until then, he was, you know, that annoying fucking guy from all those terrible comedies. But that's a bit
detour.
Yeah, quite a detour. A detour worthy of Joseph Losey.
Yeah. I agree.
So now, Aaron, what do you think his weakness is as a filmmaker?
I am so enamored with this man. I think that sometimes especially with scripts he writes, he might fall in love with the exact wording a little too much. But I can't come up with a legitimate weakness. I think that he does everything right, even in things that work less than others. I think that it's not that he did anything wrong. It's just that the idea doesn't fully come together the way that...
So he might have occasional foibles more than outright faults.
Correct.
Carl?
What week is this? Seriously. I think, and I'm sort of not being facetious about it.
Oh, no.
I think he's so personal in terms of what he wants to do that certainly if you have a difficulty with what he does, you know, it's who he is. And I think that shines so much within what he does that to me, you know, you can argue he has a weakness, but I would say that's who he is. So if you think it's a weakness, fine, but I don't think it is. I can't really honestly say, you know, that he has a weakness. I'm just that enamored of him, and that's me, okay? So that's what I'm going to say.
Harry?
I literally wrote down on my notes, he doesn't have one. I am not just following along. That's literally what I wrote down. And it's again, you know, to expound just a little bit and to drag it back to, I didn't want to chime in when we were doing this earlier, but for me, it's like I can't name anybody who matches, like, Soderbergh's formal adventurousness, Scorsese's openness to all of cinema history, Altman's offhandedness, and prime Jonathan Demme's humanity. I don't know who else has that combination, and he's never misstepped with any of those. So no, he doesn't have one.
So Carl, what's his strength as a filmmaker?
I think in a lot of ways we've gone through this, but to me it's his sense of time, his place of time, his ability to look back at an era or a place or people and make them real. And that to me is his greatest strength.
Well, I would say for me, sometimes I think that it's how he pulls amazing performances out of actors that you know, wouldn't expect. But honestly, I'm going to dig a little deeper with what you just said and go very specific. And, you know, you look at something like Apollo 10 and a half, that could have become pure nostalgia, but he makes it real. He makes that 45-minute to an hour where the kid's telling the time, you know, about his time growing up, and that evocation of the era and the place makes it so real, so relatable. It's remarkable, and he does that consistently across his work. So he's got that going for him. Aaron?
I think it's just that he has such a strong sense of himself as a filmmaker. He never questions what he's doing. He goes full speed ahead at it, and makes every project he takes on his own. And I think that takes a lot of, it takes a certain kind of courage. It's not courage, as I think most people would think of it, but courage as
conviction,
courage
maybe
to your artistic convictions. And we all know how badly things can go in the movie making business when an artist stands up to the moneyed people. And I think this is, I mean, it's definitely one of the benefits of being able to make a movie for $3 million and making two movies through the course of your career to finance the rest of them, basically. If you look at School of Rock and Bad News Bears as the movies he made to finance everything else, that's a pretty good track record. Even his animated movies, which, you know, traditionally cost a lot more, just because of the process and the number of people involved. Like, A Scanner Darkly was like $5 million. So that sounds like a lot to those of us who have zero money, but in movie terms, that's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket.
Harry?
I'll say it again. It's very much like what Aaron was just saying. It's, to me, it's his ability to conceive of exactly what the film is supposed to be and to have no – he doesn't lean on anything. Like, so, you know, Wes Anderson keeps going back to Claymation because it's the perfect form for him. He wants to control every inch of everything. So it makes total sense. But those two Claymation films aren't – they're very similar. He's working Claymation because he likes Claymation. The three rotoscoped animated films are using rotoscope in entirely different ways and for different reasons. He thinks through everything. I mean, he's using it in Waking Life to, you know, establish this universe that is taking place in dreamland. He uses it in A Scanner Darkly to give you the disassociated feeling you're getting from all the drugs. And he uses it in Apollo 10 and a half in order to let you know that this is nostalgia. This isn't real. This is this idealized memory of this. And that's brilliant. You know, he does not, he's so smart. He's such a great artist. And that's just one example. There's nothing he leans on because this is what I do. There's a reason for everything he does it. For the story, for the film he's making. He's brilliant.
And Carl?
Okay. Give me the question because I thought I answered it.
No,
I
was going to say again. I thought maybe you were just coughing, but I thought that was you. I was going to say, and Carl. Okay. So I guess we're done with this question then. So now it's going to be Perry's chance again, and that's going to be this. What are his five best films? And we're going to start with you, Perry, but we're going to do it good old Siskel and Ebert style. We're going to go down the line. We're going to start at five. Everyone answers five, then four, three, two, one. So starting with you, Perry, what's his number five film?
First of all, I hated not going to 10 for this. But I followed your rules.
Me too.
I stuck with five. And co-signing on everything Carl mentioned earlier, my five is Last Leg Flying. And I'll talk about it for all the reasons Carl said, absolutely. It is such a fantastic sequel to a fantastic movie.
It really is.
Bryan Cranston is unbelievably great. I don't know how you manage to evoke Nicholson and not do a Nicholson impression, but he does it. It's genius. But putting all that aside, this for me was my other on the short list of, you know, the undervalued films, because if I'm supposed to believe anybody who tells me that they love veterans, well, then this should have been a gigantic hit. This should have been the biggest hit on the planet, because I have never seen a movie that deals with it like that. So human, so open, so very real. It's, you know, If you catch me in a particular mood, I will tell you it's a better film than The Last Tale, and that doesn't generally – I don't say that a lot, but I think the extra years on all those characters makes it a much more profound and deeper film than The Last Tale, and The Last Tale is brilliant.
Oh, it is.
Last Tale Blind's number five.
Yep. So, Carl?
Okay, if I'm going to go number five, I'm going to go with Waking Life. Waking Life to me was amazing because it was the first film of his where I got his connection with Philip K. Dick and the whole sense of what is real, what is not. And this showed a much more philosophical sense to Linklater than I had seen before. And I thought, that's a revelation. And that was the movie that made me like, okay, I'm following this guy. I'll go wherever he leads me right now, because that's, he just grabbed me with that film. There's that whole section that basically, you know, is Philip K. Dick, and he talks about Philip K. Dick in that movie. And yeah, Waking Life, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Aaron?
Bernie, because it's that filmmaker, it's that film in every great filmmaker's oeuvre that everyone has. It's the film that shouldn't work at all, but
it
just
does.
Everything comes into place. This movie was so good that the actual Bernie was released from prison into the care of Richard Linklater. That's how good this movie was. And that's a true story, by the way.
Yeah.
Bernie was let out on parole into the custody of Richard Linklater, and last I knew still lived in the apartment above Linklater's garage. This movie is amazing, and it shouldn't be, but it is.
So going back to Parrot, or yep, number four,
School of Rock, and here is why.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's not the most. Yes, there are artier films. There are more interesting. There are more challenging films that I could have put on this list. All the ones you named, as we've established, any of them. There's no bad choice here. The man has made nothing but great movies for the most part. No, the man's made nothing but great movies, with one exception. I think that it's, School of Rock is, this doesn't happen, right? Like, I cannot think. Cassavetes never had the giant Hollywood blockbuster, right? This is not what American independent directors are supposed to do. And usually when they do it, it leads to a complete downfall. They never get back to making the films they want to make. So not only did he have a gigantic hit on a small budget, he made a film that everybody can love. My children are 22 and 19, to tell you about the time how old they were when that film came out. There is no film more quoted in my household, in my life, with my own kids and my wife and myself than this movie. We could probably recite it by heart. There is a reason I opened with a School of Rock quote this morning on the show. It so works.
Turn it on its side, and hello, it's the bass.
Yep.
It shouldn't work this well. It is so
appealing. And it does.
It is so warm. And it is about how to teach. It's not just this thing. It is a lesson in how you teach kids to do things, how you teach them skills, and how you teach them to grow up. It's amazing. School of Rock, number four.
Yeah, and actually teach them, not just get them used to following
exactly.
Rules so they eventually go from the school to prison pipeline, but let's not get into that today.
Exactly.
So, Carl, you're number four?
I'm going to concur and going to say School of Rock for a couple of different reasons, okay? You mentioned about teaching. Do you realize that there are schools of rock now, actual schools of rock in almost every urban city? There's at least 12 here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
It had such an effect, an effect on teaching. And it's also a celebration of music, and all music, not just rock, but all music is part of that. And I love that too. And the energy that Jack Black brings to that movie is just amazing. And I also have a personal, very, very personal reason for it being number four is I've always had the hots for what's her name? For
Sarah Silverman?
Come on.
Sarah Silverman.
Joan Cusack.
Oh,
okay.
Joan Cusack,
I
want to
marry the woman. I could be very crude and just say I want a boinker, but yeah.
Good Lord.
Her description is
yes, but I've had a thing about Joan Cusack for years, and I love her in that role. She's the secret ingredient to that movie. She certainly
Amen.
Is.
From Barry Warrenoff to Joan Cusack, Carl sure does run the gamut.
You should talk to Rachel. Rachel has my taste in women down to a fucking like cue. She knows.
Oh, I know. We need to do a whole show on you. This is your lifestyle podcast one day. But
I like that idea.
But Aaron, number four.
His newest masterpiece, Apollo 10 and a Half: A Space Age Childhood. This is a film that does nostalgia right. It's microscopic in its memory. It's not throwing out chintzy crap just to say, oh, I remember that. Like, that's not the point. The point is this was his life, and he lived it, and so he's going to put it on the screen. On top of that, it tells just the best. I'm trying to decide if I want to qualify that. I don't think I do. The best science fiction story for children that I have ever seen. It's just magnificent. Like, it puts a child in the most absurd situation that you can think of. And it makes it so plausible, and it makes it so urgent and immediate. And then the fallout is just so heartbreaking, but so glorious at the same time, as all things are when you're 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Glorious and heartbreaking. He rarely does things for a younger audience. But in the case of this and in the case of School of Rock, which for me are like both just fantastic.
You know,
something
tells me that his fellow Texan, Robert Rodriguez, only wishes he could go back to making kids' movies this good, or movies about childhood that are this good, I should say. So, Perry, you're number three?
Scanner Darkly, for all the reasons mentioned earlier. It is just, it's an astounding work. I don't know how anybody sees it and isn't affected by it. I'm not saying change forever, but I don't know how you experience that film and not think about a lot of things you might not have thought about before, or come to understand some things or people you have known in a way that you didn't before. It's spectacular.
Yeah, and isn't that how you know it's a work of art?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So, Carl, you're number three?
Okay, we're at number three. I think I'm also going to have to go with – hold on just a second – with Apollo 10 and a Half, because it's such a small, perfect gem.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. You know, we've talked about nostalgia, and it's true nostalgia because it's through his brain and his persona. And it captures that period of time and that place so magnificently that the minute you start watching it, you're there. You are there. And I disagree that it is a science fiction film. It's a dream film. because it's pretty obvious that this is what he wanted to happen, right? And I'm not going to give any spoilers. But to me, it's more about the dreams of a child and what we want to happen and what actually happens. And that's what makes the ending of that movie so magnificent and so heartbreaking at the same time. So yeah, for me, Apollo 10 and a half, number three.
Aaron?
No, I'm just going to say it, guys. Dazed and Confused. We have to talk about it.
Oh, yeah,
we do. It's been brought out now.
Fuck that movie.
What can I say? This is, by the way, folks, the movie that Adam doesn't like. The one that he's been skirting around all night.
It's a well-made movie. I have objections to it.
Where was I? The cast. This is one of those generational cast movies. One of those movies that introduces the mainstream to a ton of people. Ben Affleck, Adam Rapp,
Matthew McConaughey, Mila Jovovich.
Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, the list goes
Parker
on.
Parker Posey.
Warren Cochran.
I said Parker Posey. the girl from Chasing Amy, Lauren. Thank you. They're all there. Before they were in the other movies that got them famous, or
Adam Goldberg.
That's a word now. Adam Goldberg was the one whose name I was completely blanking on. So thank you.
There's so many.
This is one of the quintessential high school movies. This is one of those movies, like, when you asked how we were first introduced to Richard Linklater, like, I didn't see Dazed and Confused until I was in college because it came out when I was six, and there was no way I was watching that movie as a six-year-old, nor should anyone, for whatever it's worth. But it's one of those films that permeated the culture, and everyone knew that movie. Even it's like Fast Times, right? Everyone knows Dazed and Confused, even if they haven't seen it. The soundtrack is just phenomenal. And Richard Linklater has still not made a dime for that movie, and he will tell you about it at some point if you want to listen.
You know, I want to jump in here because Dazed and Confused would be my number six pick. And I know, you know, we were talking beforehand, Adam's difficulty with the film, and if you don't mind, I'll just state it that you feel that it celebrates bullydom. And what I would say to that is I graduated in 1975. I should have graduated in 1976 when the film was set. Okay? I endured numerous bullies, and it was not just the kids. It was the teachers. They were
absolutely
there. Okay, and the thing is, I don't think that the movie celebrates that. I think the movie puts a camera eyes on it, so you make your own decision about it. It doesn't glorify it. In fact, if you take a look at the scenes, they're rather nasty, and you're not supposed to like them. You're not supposed to like those people that do that, and it's very apparent. And this is the type of stuff that I endured. So I really, really understood, or at least from my point of view, that the film is just showing you what it was like specifically during that time about bullying, and not making any argument against or for it. And that's what you're really reacting to, is that there's no argument.
Oh, don't presume to tell what someone's reacting to.
Okay, sorry about that. But that's a lot of people have that reaction to it, and I've talked to several people on it. So that's my take on it.
So next up would be let's see, we went through, we had. So it would have been actually
Perry's number two.
Yeah, we're done with number three. So we're on to number two. So Perry.
Boyhood. I almost have no words. Me, I almost have no words. Boyhood is such it is – he pulled it off. You know, I've been talking about how much I love the fact that he conceived the movie so perfectly. Well, he held this one in his head for 14 years. I don't know anyone does that. And then pulls off a three-hour movie that both, in the best possible way, I know this sounds like an insult, feels like 14 years. Not that it's boring. Not that it's slow. I feel like I've lived 14 years or 12 years with these people. I don't know how he did it. I mean, I know how he did it, but I don't know how he did it. I find it absolutely stunning, and that it is everybody's story. I wished he'd gotten to use the 12 years title instead of Boyhood. It's a better title. It is everybody's story. It's not about just the kid by any means.
Right.
And it has the only way I can describe it is, you know, people spend billions and billions of dollars on special effects to make people look old, and he did the one thing you're not supposed to do, which is actually just let people age. And it is fantastic to watch Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke change over those 12 years, and to watch that kid grow up. Has there ever been a film that feels more lived in than Boyhood?
Very few.
Earlier, I'm gonna just chime in and say, I think there is no. There has been no greater shame in the last 20 years on the Academy than picking Birdman over this for Best Picture.
Thank you.
They went with Shallow and Slick over Deep, and it is shameful on all of them.
Yeah. You know, the thing is now, it wasn't my favorite movie of that year, but of the ones that was up, it was my number two that year. I actually preferred The Grand Budapest Hotel, which was my number one, but Boyhood kept going back and forth between being my number two and my number three that year. And I was expecting Boyhood to do a little bit better. I actually went into that Oscars having felt that Birdman had somehow gained momentum. And, you know, I liked Birdman. I thought it was a good movie, but... was it better than Budapest Hotel? Was it better than Boyhood? No, absolutely not. you know what I have been mad had Keaton won the Oscar? Oh no! Keaton was excellent. You know, we all know what didn't happen that year. So, Carl, you're number two.
My number two absolutely has to be A Scanner Darkly. And between this and the other one that's number one, it can change. Scanner Darkly is the best, most faithful Philip K. Dick adaptation ever put on film. It is magnificent. It is sad. It is funny. And personally, I think Woody Harrelson and Robert Downey Jr. should have had a side sequel on just those two. Seriously, I would have watched that as a TV show in a fucking heartbeat. I think
you know what's funny? You could still get away with it by having those two play those two characters 20 years later in a series of like 5 to 10 minute shorts that they could release once every like other month or something, like, you know, make it a web thing, little minute Minnesotas.
You know, I mean, you know, and it's the one film that really captures the humor of Philip K. Dick, because a lot of people doesn't think he has humor, and he does. To me, it is an amazing film.
If you don't see the humor in, I mean, you know, Verhoeven actually managed to capture some of Dick's humor in Total Recall, which isn't a perfect movie, but one thing it did do was capture that dark humor that that Dick had in places.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But in this case, this is much more organic. It's not.
Oh, yeah.
It's much more organic, and the, you know, I mean, you take a look at the technical expertise of the rotoscoping and that. Really, that has nothing to do with it with me. It's the passion that he brings out within the script, and also, you know, what happens in the novel, that at the end of it, you're totally destroyed. You're just, you know, I'm basically in the corner like a shivering piece of jello at the end of that movie and at the end of that novel. And he kills it in terms of doing that. I think it's one of the five best science fiction films ever made, period. I think it's brilliant.
Aaron?
The Before trilogy. I think it's just lusciously romantic, unapologetically so. The characters are so, so real. So unrealistic, but so real. It's absolutely amazing what those three pull off in this series. Those three being Linklater, Hawk, and Delby. The fact that they just picked it up 9 years later, kind of on a whim, it made an even better film than they made in 95. And then that they capped it off. And Midnight is maybe the weakest of the three, maybe. But that's really, it's not insult to Midnight so much as it's praise for Sunrise and Sunset.
Yeah, I mean, if the first two are 10 out of 10 movies, that's like a 9.5 movie.
Yeah, that's what we're saying here. Just every note in the first two films and 99% of the notes in the third one are pitch perfect. And as I said, just unapologetically romantic in the best possible way. Like, they never go for the easy story. They never go for the audience swooning reaction. It just is gorgeous. And a lesser filmmaker couldn't have even conceived of it, let alone pulled it off. As I said, when I saw Before Sunset was a movie, I can't even believe they made a sequel to that movie. Like, that's not the kind of movie that gets sequels.
No.
No, no, it's not. So, Perry, you're number one.
So, in the year of the Sight and Sound poll, I feel the need to give my little speech that I understand why it happens. I don't have a problem if anybody does it. I just can't lump series of films together. I can't. There's something about it that just rubs me wrong. So I have Before Sunset at the top. If you wanted to stand in for all three, I'm fine with that. But Before Sunset is number one for me, and it's for this reason. Along with everything that was just said. If you watch that movie, Linklater, as I talked about, has so conceived of the film, it matters with each conversation what kind of movement is going on. It matters if there is no movement. It matters if the camera is moving and they aren't. It matters if they are moving on a boat and the camera's not moving, but they're being propelled forward beyond their will. Every single moment matters. You'll notice they tend to lie about themselves to themselves when they're not moving. Then when they're sitting in that diner in the cafe early, and they're trying to pretend that this is all normal, it is so brilliantly conceived cinematically that it is. I have no problem saying this. It's the greatest real time film ever made, flat out. It's because of that. It's because it is so perfectly cinematically conceived of how he's going to communicate with everything at his disposal, what these two characters are experiencing and doing, and how they are bandying and bantering back and forth and re-falling in love. It's stunning. it's gobsmacking. It is, for my money, it is one of the two great films of this century. If I got to vote in the Sight and Sound poll, it would be on it. I think it's one of the 10 greatest films ever made. I think Before Sunset is worthy of absolute study. And do you need to have seen Before Sunrise? I'm going to say yes, but only if then you're willing to wait 9 years. I think you should have to live with it for as long as we all had to live with it before you see it for it to work as well.
Oh, you bastard!
So yes, Before Sunset. But if you want that to stand in for the trilogy, fine. But Before Sunset.
Yep. So, Carl.
I've already said it. Last Flag Flying. There's a lot of reasons for that. I have to go back to the last detail to begin with. Okay, so.
And here Carl starts talking about the 70s. Everybody take a drink of something, their favorite beverage, water, juice, booze.
Nice. Well done, Alan. Adam, I'm sorry. You caught me off guard. But my dad, I would start watching that on HBO, and my dad would come in and immediately turn it off and would never let me watch it. I had to watch it late at night once to really get it, and I loved it, and immediately then picked up the novel by Gerald Ponickson. And so Last Flag Flying is published in, I think, 2002, 2003. I didn't even know it existed, that Ponickson had gone back to these characters. And I ran across it and just out, it's on Netflix. I saw that it was Linklater, and I immediately said, well, I'm going to watch this. And then it comes up. It's written by Gerald Ponickson, and that they co-wrote the script. And then I realized, oh, my God, it's about these characters from Last Detail. And what really, really hits me on this is how real this comes and really hits you hard. If you know the previous film, and this one you need to watch Last Detail first, and you don't have to wait 30-some years, okay? Okay. But to see the little connections, like the bar that Bryan Cranston is in is the bar from the original movie where he says, we are the motherfucking Shore Patrol. It is. And it's run down and things like that. You see these little connections, and suddenly, and then you see, the Otis Young character as played by Lawrence Fishburne, as a preacher. And but it answers very simply why they went that way. And the reconnection is so real. That whole scene with the cell phones is beautiful. There's just so many things about that makes it so real and so heartfelt. I don't think there's another film he's ever done, and I think it's because of Ponickson that really makes it that real for me. I think it is a brilliant film. I think it is one of the most underrated films of this millennia. And I just will, anyone that's listening to this, please, please watch this movie. Seriously. You've got to watch this film.
Hear, hear.
And there you go.
Well, and now I'm going to jump in, and before Aaron has his chance to take us out on this question, I'm going to give my five. And my five are going to start, it's going to start with Bernie, The Last Flag Flying, Boyhood, and Apollo 10 and a half, and then, sorry, Perry, the Before trilogy. I'm going to consider
it
one story, just like I do with Godfather.
Right.
And you know, Scanner would be in there. It would be number six. But man, you know, this is just such a he has such a great filmography. And that's another reason why I decided to make it five, because he has enough movies. We could have done ten. But I wanted to make it a little harder on us. I wanted us to really, really choose our cream here. So, Aaron, what's the platinum at the top for you?
Boyhood.
Shit. And here I thought it was going to be What Happened, Bernadette. God damn it.
The greatest cinematic experiment of all time. and it tells an awfully great story as well. I've heard a lot of people complain that they can't relate to Mason and his story, which I find to be utter bullcrap, because every single kid I knew in high school who had divorced parents was exactly like Mason.
With me, I've had trouble with Mason himself not having a lot of details, with Mason feeling at times like a cipher, but his story, you know, what's happening to him and the characters around him, it's all very relatable. So people say they can't relate to what's going on. Yeah, I think that's not something that I can really get behind. I mean, maybe some people really do feel like that. I'm not going to tell anybody that they can't have that response. I certainly wouldn't, but I just would say, wow, because, you know, say what you will about the character himself, but the story, the characters around him, what's happening, it's pretty remarkable.
Let's see here. Shoot. Yes, it's a three-hour movie that simultaneously feels like it's 12 years long and an hour and a half. It is the best timed film ever made. The fact that it did not win the Oscar for Best Editing that year, and that the incredibly over-edited Whiplash beat it, is just another shame of all shames.
The fact Whiplash won anything, even for J.K. Simmons, is a damn fucking crime.
Patricia Arquette, whom I love, Patricia Arquette. I think she's wonderful, and I think this is her best role. Ethan Hawke somehow transforms himself from being just the biggest asshole absentee father to being one of the most wholesome dads in the history of film. And it's such a cool transition that you almost miss the first time you're seeing it until it's done. And it all happens so fast. What do you get? You get like 14 minutes each year of this kid's life, and you feel like you get a true idea of what's happening. And
yeah, I mean, you know, you think he's probably in about a half hour, 40 minutes of the movie, but it's less.
Yeah, it's absolutely one of the most lived-in films, as Perry said, ever made. And it's a miracle. It's a miracle of a film. It's my number 15 all time. It's my second or third top film of the century, first or second American film. It's just unreal what he accomplished with that film.
Yeah. Now, so we definitely have come to the end of that. Now, I will take this back to you, Perry, and that is, where do we put Linklater All Time?
So this is interesting. I know I normally totally punt on this question because I really do don't. I'm directors, but it got me thinking, and it never coalesced this way for me before. As I've been thinking about getting ready to do this show, which I have been so looking forward to doing, and thank you all for doing this. This is so much fun to talk about this man's work. I think the best way to describe Linklater, and I may be going out on a limb, and this may be ridiculous, I think he's the greatest American art house director ever. And I'm using that term very specifically. I'm not saying a greatest indie director. I'm not saying any of that. I think he's the greatest American art house filmmaker ever. And I think that's incredibly high praise, because it is.
I think we're all speechless now.
I'm considering it. Yeah, well, I think there's an argument to be made that he's at least in that conversation. So,
I agree with.
So, Carl?
I think if you take a look at Linklater, you have to connect him to two other directors who I think between the three of them are the best American, quote, indie directors or art house directors out there. And that would be Linklater, that would be Soderbergh, and that would be Wes Anderson. I think all of them are phenomenal. I think when it's all said and done, you take a look in history, they're going to be up there, certainly in top 20 American directors. I don't think there's any question. Who out of those three would probably be best out of those three? That's a good friggin' question. But there is no doubt that Linklater has really laid a claim for his work and for what he's done and what he continues to do.
You mentioned Wes Anderson. You could also put Paul Thomas Anderson because
Anderson in that too. I'm not as enthralled with him as I am with Wes, but that's a personal case for me.
Oh, sure.
You know, but no, you could definitely put Paul Thomas Anderson in that. No question.
And finally to you, Aaron.
Well, you all know about my, director tier list, right?
Yeah.
No, we've never heard of it.
You've got Bergman on top. Then you've got your Titans, which takes you to your top 13. And then Mount Olympus, which takes you to your top 25. He is solidly on Mount Olympus. He's maybe not Zeus, maybe, but he's definitely Ares. He's a major, major figure on Mount Olympus.
Could he be Poseidon? He's Poseidon or Ares, right? Maybe Apollo?
He could definitely be, Apollo might be the best. Apollo might be the best one for him. He's very wise.
If he's wise, wouldn't that be... I just forgot my Greek mythology.
Artemis? Apollo is the god of wisdom.
Yeah, I was thinking he was also the god of, he was the other one, but yes, it's Apollo and both of them, yep. Okay, go on.
I don't get that specific. He's definitely hard and fast top 25 all time for me. As I said, like He's the only filmmaker who's made this many films that I can't choose one that I truly dislike. And that includes guys like Bergman, Kubrick, Scorsese, Kurosawa, like guys that I would put in higher esteem just because of the number of just monolithic masterworks that they've made. They all falter somewhere along the line, and Linklater for me has never truly let me down. And just one of my absolute favorites.
Well, I think that's it for the major questions. So my next one will be to say that we're going to go to do housekeeping, and I'll turn it over briefly to Carl. So what do we have coming up on Deviant Legion?
Okay, so on Deviant Legion, I can tell you this, that on Sunday, we've got Rock This Town with TC. He's going to be out, but I will be subbing for TC, and we're going to be doing Noah's Rock Boat Part 2, Carl's Picks, and they're all going to be 15 songs about animals, and so it'll be a lot of fun, and that's what we're doing. Now, on Monday, we're continuing our commentary watches on back-to-school movies, and we're going to be doing this with Josh Buckland. And we're going to do a commentary on the movie If. Now, those of you that know me know how much I love Lindy Anderson and the McTravis trilogy. And this one is a very savage look at the British education system. So we're going to do that. I can also tell you that on Thursday, we're going to finish up our commentary watches with Back to School with a watch of The Odd Life of Timothy Green, a very unusual Disney movie that was actually written by Ahmet Sapa. You might not know that, but it's a personal favorite of mine. And, of course, then we talk about next. Okay, on Thursday, I can tell you this, it's not set up yet in the episode, but we're going to be welcoming back Danny Perry to the podcast. Danny is he's going to be on actually the 14th, and he is the writer and author of the cult movie books from the 80s, and really great guy. He's going to have questions for us. It's just going to be a free, free-form fun episode. So we're going to be doing that. And then, of course, next week, today, you have another show. So why don't you talk to us, Adam, about what you're going to be doing next week?
Yep. Next week, Cathro Gray Mission will be back with a look at the first season of the Netflix series Sandman, based on the comic book series by Neil Gaiman. We will also be looking a little bit at the comics as well, particularly those storylines on which these episodes were based. That will be Friday, September 9th. We will not be back on the 16th, but we will be back on the 23rd. And on the 23rd, we will be doing an episode on Star Trek, the original series, the classic 79. So please make sure if those sound good, come in and join us. Listen, should be a lot of fun. And I will also say that this month marks our third anniversary here on Cathode Ray Mission. So all the episodes really starting with Better Call Saul a couple weeks back and going through what we have scheduled through the end of September. I'm kind of considering a third anniversary celebration, so please join us. And now having said that, I will do what I always do before I take us out, and that is, Carl, Are there any quick comments, one or two, something that we haven't brought up that you'd like to bring up about Linklater before we go?
Yeah, I'd like to just mention two things, and it both goes to Boyhood and also the Before trilogy. The Before trilogy, I think, is a great trilogy. You will notice I didn't say much about it. I think in a lot of ways, personally, it's a little too romantic for me. I tend to like the romanticism of someone like Alan Rudolph, who's a little more off the beaten track. But yet they are magnificent films, and they definitely should be watched. And there's no question that they should be at the top of somebody's list for Linklater. As far as Boyhood, I always felt, you know, in music, there are theoreticians like John Cage. And to me, that's his John Cage movie. I didn't connect to it because I saw the technique more than I saw the film. And that's, again, a personal thing for me. But I also think that it's a magnificent film. And I think the other thing, too, is at least of what I've seen, and I haven't seen everything in Linklater's, there's not a weak film that I've seen. So, you know, it's well worth whatever your opinion. It's dead on. You know, they're great films. So that's all I have to say.
Perry.
Okay. A couple facts. Let's do, first of all, to go back an hour or so, Aaron, yeah, absolutely. Everybody wants some. It's one of the great baseball movies, right? Like, that
absolutely
is what baseball players are like. It's not about baseball. It's about what baseball players are like. A dear friend of mine who loves Linklater said, Perry, I hated that movie because it reminded me of what it was like to be around jocks in high school. And I was like, yep, I understand why you hated it. That doesn't bother me as much. But I totally get that. That's how good that movie is. And, I mean, I can't believe how many films of his I so like. I love, like, the films we have not even mentioned, stuff like Fast Food Nation is so smart and worth checking out, and nobody else would have made it. It's on that very, very short list of films, along with Mean Girls, of fantastic fiction films made out of nonfiction books. It doesn't happen often. Check that out if you've never seen it. And I want to stick up for Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which I'm stunned at how hot
I think it's a good movie.
That movie was from so many people. I talked to so many people who thought, why should I care about this character? I'm like, how can you not care about this character?
Well, you know, I mentioned it to Aaron when I was watching the movie. I said, you know, I'm watching this, and it's the funniest thing, but I couldn't help shake the feeling that it's his Cameron Crowe movie. You know?
See, well, what I love about it, I understand why you're there, but what I love about it is I cannot think of another Linklater film, where the art direction is so important. He's letting you know what's going on with her, with all of those sets. He's deep into his career. He is still, you know, flexing new muscles. And trying.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I, we were sitting there watching it, and all the plants growing in the house, and the way that the house was definitely not, you know, well taken care of. It wasn't that they were, you know, you go and you say, is it a dump? Oh, are they renovating it? Is there something wrong here? Is this just really a weird house? And you start asking these questions, and that takes you in to the important questions that the film's going to be grappling with. It's really good stuff.
And Cate Blanchett and Billy Crudup are superb in it. So, yes.
You know, I actually hated Crudup for a minute in there because he was such a prime asshole. And I mean that not just because he was a jerk, but he was an asshole to be so easily manipulated. And I'm like, you fucking piece of shit. Wake up. Hey, see, all of you have seen it, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know. Yeah.
Love Billy Crudup.
Um, Yeah, yeah. No, I'm glad somebody mentioned that. No, I think that, you know, I mean, it's not his best film, but it's definitely one that I looked at some of the reviews for it, and I'm like, really? People are hating on this?
And it's his only, to this point, female-centered film. Truly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so he could even does that well. Can't the man.
Yeah, do. Yeah. So, finally to you, Aaron, anything that you want to say? Last words on this?
Well, Harry stole my thunder a little bit because I was going to mention that nobody mentioned Fast Food Nation, which may actually make it his most underrated movie. It's another one of those movies that really shouldn't work. That there's nothing, like, if you just describe the plot to someone, you would do it pass. Hard pass, go away, I don't want to talk to you anymore. But it does, like, everything in it, like, it's one of those massive tapestry films. He's almost channeling 90s Altman. It's very much like Shortcuts in a lot of ways, where all of these interconnected stories that feel like they're disjointed all come together, but not in, like, a coincidental way, in, like, a very real and profound way that is very satisfying at the end of the film. I think that's one – I think it's actually his lowest-rated film on IMDb, which, I mean, it's IMDb, who cares? But it's another indication of, you know – a movie being underappreciated for what it is.
Unfortunately, I think the only people that care about IMDb anymore are casting agents and producers.
And so I just wanted to make sure that Fast Food Nation got its fair shakes, because it had, until Perry mentioned it 5 minutes ago, literally been the only of his 19 films that we did not even name the title of. So,
and you know, it's funny, I hadn't realized that until we got to that point, because I guess I kept expecting one of you guys to mention it. I said, no, I'm not going to mention that. One of them is going to have it. I'll let them have the movie. And then nobody did. Because I kind of expected you, Aaron.
Really
I honestly
wonderful.
Expected you to mention it.
Well, I mean, there's only so much I can do, you know.
I already had
my full like Will Ferrell cheerleading get up on for this episode. I wasn't going to deep dive to Fast Food Nation and start championing its merits until I had to.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that will be the note on which we take this out. So I hope everyone out there that was listening enjoyed this. I hope anyone who comes to this later enjoys it as much as we enjoyed making this. Thank you guys for coming in. And you three will be back next week along with another guest. So, yes, folks. We got the crew back plus one. So see you then. And on the count of three, we'll all say goodnight. One, two, three. Goodnight.
Baby, you're going to miss that plane.
Don't let the bed bugs bite.